Good afternoon. Welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Amy Phillips. Coming up for you, an organic livestock buyer is imploring landholders not to relinquish the organic status of their property, saying there will be restocking options when the drought breaks. In the meantime,
I'd say blackall out of all of our supply would be probably the worst I've seen it. Generally, this is pretty ordinary.
Peter Gall from Arcadian says the paddocks have never looked so devoid of pasture. And cucumbers, they're wrapped in plastic because it helps them to last longer on the shelf at the supermarket. But with a push to reduce waste, a new group has been formed to try and find some middle ground. And in some good news, young cattle were up in price at the Toowoomba cattle sale due to rain over the weekend. We'll bring you some of the better rain totals and prices for those cattle around the state in the next hour. First up, though, and let's talk about organic, where organic livestock producers in Western Queensland say they're questioning the value of their organic status as the drought marches on. Bill Tomlinson runs organic sheep and cattle at Elmina Station, which is about 80 kilometres east of Wyandra, and says finding supplementary feed is nearly impossible. He says he's seriously looking at his options.
We have been in drought for a long time, and now we're finding it very hard to source organic feed. If we can actually source it, it's at a very high price. So we have decided to let our organic status on our cattle slip away until such time as it rains again. Our property will remain organic because we have to feed organic hay and non-organic hay, that sort of thing, so that because we're unable to source organic feed.
Is it typically difficult to get organic food to these regions?
It is more difficult than obviously than buying non-organic feed, but this time it's because the drought's so widespread and so long lasting. I think that the normal amount of organic feed that's on the market has obviously been used up, and it's just not available.
What would you typically categorise as organic feed? I know that there's hay types that are organic, but is there anything else that you can use that is organic?
We buy DCP so that our cows can have access to phosphorus, and that's probably our major input apart from hay in normal times. Normally we make our own hay so that we don't have problem, you know, finding hay, but at the moment seems like it's just about non-existent, so we've done the only thing that we intend to do, the only thing that we can.
We're in the middle of mulga country. Is it possible to push mulga and feed that to organic cattle?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, pulling mulga or pushing mulga or whatever is fine. The only difference then is instead of the tree standing up, it's lying down when they're eating it. That gives them much more access to a lot more feed. It actually probably, we think, does the mulga bush good. A young growing mulga bush is good feed, and it probably takes in more carbon than an old tree, so probably good for the environment as well.
Is it possible to, if you're not able to source organic materials, to put your cattle just onto the mulga?
Oh yeah, they do need supplement though to do well.
Is this the case for most people that are in organics in this region, or have you found that it's been okay for others?
No, I think that I know some of the others certainly are struggling to find feed, and some of them have done the same thing that we're doing. Others have still persisted, but I think eventually they must run out of organic feed.
And you mentioned that you're actually also running organic sheep. Can you talk to me about how they're doing, and is it better or worse than the cattle situation?
Well, our sheep have done quite well right through on the low mulga, so that we haven't had to worry about them. You know, they're right at this stage.
Would you say that it would be beneficial for yourself or even others that are thinking about staying organic to go maybe just to sheep?
Yeah, I would think that you would still want to run some cattle, probably these farms in the mulga country, best run as a mixed farm. That would be my thoughts anyway.
And how is the market looking at the moment just for organics?
Oh, it's it'll be holding a little bit better than the, quite a bit better than the ordinary market. The ordinary market, cattle market at the moment's in a fair mess. A bit of general rain would certainly make a huge difference there.
Bill Tomlinson from Elmina Station, which is east of Wyandra, speaking with Anita Bolay. And if you're wondering, DCP, which Bill was speaking about, is desiccated coconut powder. It's fed to organic cattle to counteract phosphorus deficiencies in that neck of the woods. Meanwhile, livestock manager for an organic meat company says he's never seen the paddocks of Western New South Wales and Western Queensland looking so ordinary. Peter Gall from Arcadian Organics says he's been fielding hundreds of calls from landholders who supply organic cattle and sheep in those areas, wondering what their options are after another failed wet season. I spoke to him earlier.
This right now is fairly unprecedented. The whole east coast of Australia is in drought conditions. So up until about 6 weeks ago, if someone's dry, we'll move those cattle to another supplier in a better area. We've run out of places to go in the last 6 weeks, 2 months. So now it's got to the point we're processing cattle we probably don't want to process, but we're helping out our suppliers. But it's got to the point younger cattle are leaving our system at the moment, which is a concern because, you sell a weaner now, we're looking at a shortfall in 2020.
What about cows? Are they coming forward too?
They are, and we have processed quite a few cows, but I think a lot of suppliers are now down to their core breeding herd and they're trying to hang on to them, so they are feeding those cows. But some cows that have gone on adjustment to non-organic places will love lost their organic certification.
I was going to say people are questioning whether or not they can keep their organic certification. I understand Bill Tomlinson, who we've just heard from, is one person. How many phone calls have you had on that front?
Obviously hundreds of phone calls. Look, in the last 5 or so years, the inputs for organic has increased a lot. There's grain licks, there's liquid supplements, which is great to see, but obviously there's a shortfall at the moment, especially with organic hay. We are getting some hay come forward, but generally there's a big shortfall at the moment. I don't think we're on our own. Everyone in a grass-fed program at the moment be short of any input.
How many of your organic producers actually supplement?
That's a good question. I'd say at least half of them are supplementing. As a rule, our suppliers are generally fairly conservative stockers on their place, so they tend to last longer than your normal conventional grower. So up until now, only really half of them. And now I've got suppliers that are just, rather than feed, they're just selling into the conventional market.
Are people getting a premium for the cattle they are turning off, the organic cattle?
The cattle they're processing, of course, but if they go into the conventional system, I don't believe they would be, which is concerning. I would say at the end of this drought, they'll get a considerable premium. So, that's why they're hanging on.
Overall, if I pick up the phone and talk to you about my concerns with my organic property, let's say Blackall, what are my options? What should I be doing? Peter Gall, what are you telling people?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've had that thrown at me quite a bit. Like a lot of our suppliers are obviously getting rid of right down to their weaners and some are unloading breeders. I believe we'll be able to get breeders back on there. Their calves will be organic, but the cows won't be in the future. We've also got the Northern Territory. There's quite a few organic suppliers up there with quite a large number, so they can come onto these places. We can lease places, we can adjust places. There's a lot happening in this supply area. So I'm telling them not to worry. If they keep the property certified organic and the cattle drop out, not the end of the world. I believe we can fill those properties after it rains.
What does this in the long term mean for Arcadian and your customers?
The long term. Well, I don't want to worry about it twice, but obviously in 2020, with the amount of weaners that are going out of the system now, it's concerning. We are implementing strategies where we're bringing more supply on. Mm-hmm. We've got business partners that are buying more country and getting it certified organic. So we're implementing strategies in that department.
Because on the other end of the spectrum, demand for organics continues to increase.
The market, I was just talking to our CEO yesterday, the market is unbelievably good. The US continues to grow, China, Korea, well, all of Asia is growing in the organic world. So, all you need to do is add water.
Can you say the same for your organic lamb and pork?
Oh, definitely. We used to have a great market into the US with our organic lamb, but we had to scrap that program because we didn't have enough supply. So right now we're only supplying a small domestic program. So the lamb world is just, the world is your oyster if you can uh, you can supply an organic lamb. And the pork program continues to grow. It's quite exciting.
How are those two industries going with this drought?
The lamb side of it obviously is terrible. Our major area for supply of lambs is Western New South Wales, and it's quite diabolical actually. So not too good. The pork program is going very well, and it isn't greatly affected except for grain prices.
That's the thoughts of Peter Gall, a livestock manager for Arcadian Organic, who's based in Toowoomba.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
From some tough news about the drought, let's go to some good news. And as we know, there's been some really lovely rain around over the weekend. And while it didn't penetrate into those western areas, it was definitely patchy, but it was also a relief for those who found themselves under it. The Bureau of Meteorology says overall, in the last 24 hours to 9 a.m, just to update everybody, there's been 84 millimetres fall at Kawanyama, 37 millimetres at Topaz, which is south of Cairns, 124 millimetres has fallen in the last 24 hours at Tyro, 52 millimetres at Somerset Dam in the Brisbane Valley, and 27 millimetres on top of the very low Leslie Dam near Warwick. Some lovely totals for the last day there. But overall, totals from the weekend, according to posts on social media, a pleasure to read. 90 millimetres has been recorded across country near Toogoolawa, nearly 200 millimetres on the border at Gundawindi, mostly in town, we understand, 84 millimetres at Dalma in central Queensland, and 94 millimetres south of Emerald. Some incredible falls and a really great start, everybody's saying. The list goes on. Let's hear from some of the winners over the weekend. Michelle Chicken at Boyne River Pecans got a decent drop with 50 millimetres in the gauge.
It's been a really tough year as far as irrigation's concerned. So our peak watering period is sort of November to now, and these trees have had no real in-crop rain since the first week of December. So irrigation's been absolutely pivotal, and you can't substitute rain, you know, no matter how much you try. So just how the trees and how the pastures and the paddocks and the grasses and the cattle and everything have just responded from just a small amount of rain in comparison to, you know, what our usual season is, has been phenomenal.
What will it mean for upcoming season?
We're sort of nearing the end of our watering cycle from the harvest. Usually starts around Anzac Day, but we don't know why, but it seems to be fairly spread across different pecan groves in Queensland and northern New South Wales. And the crop has gone a lot earlier this year, and we're starting to think that the only thing that we can sort of lead that to is, you know, the lack of sort of in-crop rain this year, no matter how much irrigation we've tried to put on. But it'll definitely give a really good moisture profile in the final stages of that nut development.
Mm. And 2 inches is definitely a fairly decent drop, but is this enough, or are you still looking for a bit more rain?
No, we definitely love some. We're certainly very grateful for what we have, because obviously there's others out there that haven't had what we have, but never say no to a little bit more.
That's the very humble Michelle Chicken from Boyne River Pecans, 50 millimetres on the trees there. So lovely to hear. An agricultural consultant in central Queensland has described the rain as a game changer for farmers in that area looking to plant winter crops. Graham Spackman says there was up to 100 millimetres recorded around Emerald, mostly south of town, off the back of the region experiencing its driest summer since the 1800s.
Well, it's a game changer for some farmers. It's been quite patchy. The areas sort of north of Emerald and particularly north of Claremont pretty much missed out. Capella area got some reasonably good rain, but the best rain seemed to be Emerald and south of Emerald, where growers have got anywhere from 60 to 80 odd millimetres quite typically. It was desperately needed to try and get us start a profile of soil moisture for winter crop planting. And of course, all the graziers are desperately needing some rain to fill up some dams and get some grass growing.
So you're talking about building that moisture profile for different crops.
A lot of profiles are very dry, and this has been a good start, but we will need more rain to similar amounts again to top up the profiles and give us some confidence.
Do you think this rain will affect water allocations at all?
Well, I noticed Fairburn Dam has had a little bit of a run-in, but it's probably not enough at this stage to affect allocations going forward.
Graham Spackman, Emerald Ag Consultant, speaking with Jemima Burt. In southern Queensland, some also managed to get a few decent falls of rain there. Tony Dugnall, a stone fruit and avocado grower near Cumbia, north of Dalby, measured 50 millimetres.
Well, it makes everything look and feel a lot nicer, but no, look, it's to put it in perspective, we've been watering stone fruit trees during summer, and for us to water stone fruit trees is very out of the ordinary. In the 30 years we've been doing it, in growing them, we've probably done it twice. So it just goes to show how dry our summer's been this year. But they'll really enjoy it. And our avocados, well, they like the water. We even though we can irrigate them, our irrigation water is with being so dry, it can get a bit salty. But they'll really enjoy this rain. And yeah, it'll as I say, you can't irrigate anything better than what Mother Nature can water it.
Gardeners would agree with you there, Tony Dugnall, from near Cumbia. Further south, Gundawindi measured up to 200 millimetres in town. Quite a sight, I understand, to wake up to on Sunday morning, but it was pretty isolated. One of the luckier ones, though, was Josh Hoffman at Kingswood, which is west of Gundawindi. He measured 70 millimetres.
Geez, I think we'd need, to get it properly full, we'd have to have at least 10 inches to get it properly full, but I think, you know, if we could get 6 or 7 inches, yeah, you'd definitely be thinking about it anyway.
Yeah, I understand you guys had to stop watering the lawn in December. Is there enough water in the dam now that, you know, the lawn might be back on the cards?
No, we haven't had any runoff yet, so it's still no go for the lawn. But, yeah, we just hope that we get a good fall to get the creeks running and, yeah, we can get some water into some dams, yeah.
Josh Hoffman from Bungunya, west of Gundawindi, who was explaining to Lydia Burton how he'd need a lot more rain to fill dams and creeks in his neck of the woods. That's a bit of a wrap of rain right now. I'll bring you some more later.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
But it sounds like a no-brainer. Cut out plastics in fresh produce and it's a win for the environment. But reducing plastics, the wrapping around your cucumber, the plastic bag your salad comes in, could reduce the shelf life of produce and lead to more food waste. Tackling this dilemma is the new Australian Fresh Produce Alliance, a brand new group that's been formed to reduce plastic packaging in a way that's hopefully sustainable. CEO Michael Rogers told Jody Gunders the group has been formed to celebrate the opportunities for horticulture.
There are a range of challenges in labour, in packaging, but some of those are focused on addressing the growth opportunities. So as something grows, there are a range of challenges that are thrown up. So the companies have got together to work through in a really constructive way to address those challenges facing industry.
People would like to see less plastic, that's clear, and there's a lot of plastic in some fresh produce, but a lot of it's there for a reason. Is there a danger with throwing the baby out with the bathwater?
Yeah, certainly. That's something that we're really looking at. People are concerned about packaging and plastic, but they're also concerned about food waste. And packaging can play a really key role in minimising food waste by extending the shelf life. So when you take the food home, it stores fresher for longer and provides more value for families. So we're looking to understand those issues better and to demonstrate that for consumers and help to bring some balance into that conversation.
So how do you bring balance in? Is it about having different sorts of products, perhaps biodegradable packaging rather than plastic? What do you do?
Yeah, look, there's some of the challenges, and the companies for the last 3 years have been progressively looking at their packaging to improve recyclability and also to look at biodegradable options. And some of the challenges are the higher cost of biodegradable packaging. And so some of the future work is looking at better packaging, ensuring that it's recyclable, and then increasingly looking at biodegradable. So it's a multi-pronged approach and to engage with the community to demonstrate the benefits of packaging and also where packaging is going.
In terms of coming together as an alliance, has that come about because there's been a lot of individual negotiating going on, different companies doing different things, mixed messages? What's been the rationale?
So horticulture is a really diverse industry. There's lots of products, there's lots of growers, and that's a great thing. There's diversity all across Australia. But it also provides a bit of a challenge in everyone coming together. So this group was brought together to bring together some of the key companies, but also some of the key supply chains, working with more than 1,000 growers. So it is a new development, and it reflects the growth in the industry and the opportunity that these companies have come together to say, hey, let's work together to support the growth of the industry overall and address some of these challenges.
You've got some big players here as part of the alliance. What about some of the smaller growers? If changes are made at this level, will those changes flow on to them? Will there be support for smaller growers to make changes?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a key challenge. And from the group's perspective, they're working with a range of small growers in commercial arrangements. So, as I said, there are more than 1,000 growers that these 14 companies work with. And so they're very conscious of working with industry more broadly, both those companies that they work with directly, but also the range of players through industry. So everything will be done in consultation with industry more broadly, looking at the challenges that we need to address and working through where we need to go in the long term and how industry can move forward.
This is a very new group. It's just been formed. Tell me a little bit about, in terms of timelines, what you hope to achieve and how soon.
Yeah, look, it is a new group. And one of the key factors is making sure that we move forward sensibly and constructively. And so we've been having a range of conversations with the companies and increasingly with other industry players and with government to make sure that we understand the issues and consider the way forward. So in terms of progress, look, we hope to make some significant steps in terms of packaging and also in labour over the next 6 months. And we have been working with the companies to consolidate what we are doing on packaging, and over the next couple of months hope to work with the retailers and industry more broadly to start sharing some of that work. So look, we are moving forward, but we are doing that in consultation, collaboration with retailers and with government and with growers.
I look forward to hearing more from that group. That's Michael Rogers, CEO of the new Australian Fresh Produce Alliance, tackling issues like the wrapping around cucumber. It actually extends the shelf life of the cucumber, but in a world where waste is a problem, they're trying to reduce it. We'll bring more on that story to you as it progresses. Now, coming up on the Country Hour, it's nearly 12:30. After the weather, while we are seeing grass sell properties in the northwest at the moment, will a property with coal seam gas wells on it also pique your interest? We speak with a property agent on his decision to emphasise CSG rental income in the Surat Basin. First up, though, let's check news headlines. G'day, Jodie Gunders.
G'day, Amy. Foreign Minister Maurice Payne has left the door open to the accused Christchurch gunman being deported to Australia. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says she's receiving briefings about the possible deportation of Australian man Brenton Tarrant after his trial. Meanwhile, security is set to be bolstered at places of worship around Australia in response to the attack. Federal government grants will pay for security upgrades, including CCTV, alarms and bollards. Queensland Senator Fraser Anning says he was right to slap a 17-year-old in the face after the teenager cracked an egg over his head. Mr. Anning has compared his actions to Australian soldiers fighting in the trenches during war. And Brisbane City Council has announced it'll extend the permit for Lime scooters in the city, saying it's satisfied both the company and Queensland Police have responded to safety concerns. Maybe we'll see them in the regions, Amy.
Jodie Gunders, thank you. Let's now check the weather forecast. We've got Bureau of Meteorology forecaster on the line, Gabriel Brunesco. G'day.
Hello, good afternoon.
Cyclone Trevor's got us all wondering. Where's he heading to at this stage, and how much rain is he delivering at this stage?
Well, just the system developed last night, intensified actually last night, was named at 5 a.m. this morning, and the next name in the list appeared to be Trevor. Category is one system at the moment, sustaining winds 85 kilometers per hour near the center and gusts up to 120 kilometers per hour. It's just sitting around 250 kilometers east of Lockhart River, so east of Peninsula, and it's moving slowly towards the eastern peninsula coast, moving at 9 kilometers per hour in a west-southwest-westward direction, and is forecast to intensify, to continue to intensify tonight and tomorrow. Forecast to make a landfall as a very strong Category 2 system near Lockhart River on late Tuesday evening. From there, the system will cross the peninsula during Wednesday and move into the Gulf of Carpentaria on Wednesday night or early Thursday. And from there, the system is likely to continue to move in a southwestward direction across the Gulf of Carpentaria and likely to re-intensify to cyclone strength, possibly even reaching higher categories as it does so as it moves across across the Gulf of Carpentaria.
Can you hint what it might do then? I'm wondering if anyone in inland Queensland could expect it to head south.
It's too far to talk about the further the movement out of 4 or 5 days time. So up to let's say what is certain from tomorrow evening, we are looking at increasing winds along the coast, gales appearing actually from tonight over Peninsula coast and then extending into Torres Strait and Gulf of Carpentaria. But with the system, we expect destructive wind gusts on the coast. Also, abnormal high tides on the eastern peninsula coast developing on Tuesday morning and Wednesday morning. And also heavy rainfall leading to flash flooding over the far north Queensland. At the moment, the heavy rainfall is sitting with the system just offshore. But from tonight, we are looking at increasing rainfall on the eastern peninsula coast. And more likely Tuesday, Wednesday, we are looking at peak rainfall, 200, 400 millimeters likely on the eastern peninsula coast. We have a flood watch, or is likely to be issued early this afternoon, basically north of Cairns. In the long term, the system it's forecast to move in the southwest direction and make landfall again over the somewhere over the top end in the Northern Territory, and from there on, it's the further movement and development of the system. It's a bit unsure.
And would it be fair to say, that's okay, thank you, yeah. Would it be fair to say too, apart from some storms around the southeast today, that most weather will be fine and sunny except for that peninsula area?
Well, everywhere else, yeah, would be mostly sunny conditions, just some showers along the central coastal areas and the coast. In the southeast, we've seen really good falls with over the weekend, and actually from Thursday with that upper trough slow moving over the southeast. And we've seen a rainfall reaching, 200 to 300 along the coast, with the highest fall Gold Coast, 307 millimeters from Thursday. Further inland, 50 to 100 widespread rainfall, but that upper trough clears offshore. We're still going to see some activity today, very decent activity in terms of showers and storms, some isolated falls and also possible severe storms with large hail and damaging wind gusts in the southeast. But from tomorrow, as that upper trough moves offshore, we're looking at sort of easing rainfall trend in the southeast, likely to pick up again from Thursday as yet a second upper trough will move over the southeast, but not as heavy as we had over the weekend.
And there are some storms moving through the southeast at the moment. Any of those severe?
Well, we had a severe gust reported just west of Toowoomba, 50 knots at Wellcamp, and they are very tiny storms, but they do still have potential for some damaging wind gust, also some heavy rainfall, and why not some large hailstones. So we're looking now, there will be some warnings pretty sure issued with those storms.
Gabriel Brunesco from the Weather Bureau, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
While we're speaking of the weather, let's turn our attention back to the incredible dry that does continue to grip most of the nation. A dairy farmer just south of the Queensland border says he's spending $1,000 a day on feed due to the drought. Tony Wilson has a robotic dairy near Kyogle. He's just cut his herd back from 220 head to 160 cows in an effort to reduce his feed costs. But he told Kim Honan he's still going backwards.
We've been buying in hay and grain and molasses for every animal for the last 6 months. it's been quite expensive.
Right. So how much are you losing a day?
Our feed costs are $1,000 a day. That is our milk income at this point in time. Everything else is above that.
Can you put a figure on how much?
If this drought continues to June, I'd say it will have cost us about $300,000. At the moment, we're fairly well established, so we can absorb that, technically speaking, for a while. But we definitely don't want the drought continuing for too much longer than that.
Well, you run a robotic dairy. Is that a larger cost for you? Does that make things harder?
Well, the whole system works on cows being able to get fed and wanting to come to the dairy and then move to another area. So that's just a little thing we've had to work around. But we have two feeding areas now with the total mixed ration, so that's making that work. But we are paying for that system in a time when we're paying a lot for our feed too. So we're sort of doubling up on costs at the moment.
And is that dairy something that you're still paying off?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. So it's 3 or 4 years ago, yeah.
And so given the current situation, do you regret investing in a robotic dairy?
I often say, at the time, our industry was travelling along quite well. And we did our budget at back then in 2012, and it was quite doable. In the 5 years in between, our costs have risen markedly in nearly everything across the board on the farm. CPI has also increased everything accordingly, and our milk income per litre stayed pretty much the same. Now with the drought, we're paying twice as much for our food.
What sort of difference do you think Norco lifting its price 6.5 cents a litre will make from the 1st of April?
That's almost a 10% increase for us. So we're doing about 60 cents now. So another 6.5 on top of that will be 10%. So, that will help. The number being bandied around by my neighbours and people I talk to now is that 80 cents a litre is what we really need to survive the drought and move forward. Yeah, that's for people who are incurring debt or increasing their debt from the drought. So that will have to be repaid at some stage. So going forward, 80 cents will get us over the line there.
What sort of difference do you think it would make if Coles ended $1 milk and actually lifted the price of its home brand product?
The only thing that would be a winner for the dairy farmers if we actually reverted to what milk should be being paid at. So it's at least $1.50 a litre for that, what I would call cheaper milk, and then everything else can be priced accordingly to that.
Tony, how much longer do you think you can hang on and stay in this industry at, I guess the current rate?
We're resilient farmers, so we have faith that we'll be able to handle the storm, but it's a pointy end coming, so let's hope it's not too close to home.
Gee, we're thinking of you, Tony Wilson, a dairy farmer from The Risk near Kyogle on the New South Wales North Coast. Let's head further north now, and on the Sunshine Coast, a dairy farmer there is looking at every part of his operation in an effort to reduce his feed costs. Queensland Dairy Farmers Association Vice President Matthew Trace milks 60 cows near Kenilworth. While he was lucky enough to receive more than 100 mils of rain in the gauge over the weekend, it just does not rain money, and the drought is still taking its toll.
The drought affects you in many ways on a dairy farm. Obviously, you have less feed on farm, but also a big factor is the bought-in feed, buying grain for dairy cattle. Dairy cattle really need some grain in their diet. They're a high-performance animal, and in many cases, this has doubled in the last 18 months, the cost. So, people are trying to either feed a bit less grain or grow some of their own, whereas previously they just bought it in.
How much are you paying for a tonne of grain?
We buy a prepared meal from a mill, so it's got grain and other additives in it. It's been over $550 a tonne, and 18 months, 2 years ago, that might have been about $300.
What does that do to your bottom line?
Oh, it really does hurt. It's a bill that just keeps on coming, and it's much, much larger than it was before. You could go through 20 tonne of grain in a month, so it doesn't take long to realise that's big bickies.
Now, looking out over these paddocks, some of those fields are bright green, so I'm guessing that's your feed. What have you been doing to try to replace some of that expensive grain that you're getting in?
Yeah, quite a few different things. So we have a bit of lucerne here, which is supposed to provide the protein in the diet. And we've also got some Liberty White sorghum. It's a grain sorghum, and we've been cutting it for silage, so we can put that in bunkers and use that wet grain that's stored in silage to replace some of the expensive bought-in grain.
How long does that last?
Really, it can last indefinitely. So with silage, you exclude the oxygen, you compact it with a tractor after it's been chopped, and then you cover it in a plastic film with tyres and weight it down, and it seals off from oxygen and preserves, so it's like a preserved feed.
How much more have you been planting?
Oh, you've got to be really careful about what you plant, so it might not necessarily be more, but it's getting the timing right and the right products that can stand dry conditions, and also to really replace some of that grain that you have to buy.
We've been pretty lucky here and we've had rain of late. How much of a difference has that made to production for you?
Yeah, we have been lucky on the Sunshine Coast. Like, it's been drier than usual and that has affected us. But we haven't had no rain. You know, there is some rain. It does look green. We're growing some crops and there's some water in the river. So, yeah, we're going okay.
Some is better than none, hey. That's Matthew Trace, a dairy farmer from Kenilworth, speaking with Jennifer Nichols. And now it's not just dairy farmers, organic producers, which we've heard from already, struggling in this drought, but producers in total are wondering where we're heading with this drought. Peter Lucas from Cliffdale Station, west of Wandra, not too far from Bill Tomlinson's block, says it's dire for all in his shire.
All this area here, especially, you know, talk about the Paroo Shire in particular, is very bad. Unless we get some rain very shortly, this is probably our sixth or seventh year in drought now. I mean, we've just lost count of how long we've been feeding animals for. Most of the people here would be lucky if they had 20% of their livestock normal running carrying capacities left. It just doesn't look like it wants to rain, and it's hung out as long as they have, and they just know that if we go into the winter without any rain, then it'll be real dire straits then.
We've seen that there has been a big push for wild dog fencing in regions across the west. How is that benefiting graziers? Are people looking to try and restock with sheep?
Yeah, they are in places. The biggest problem we have here, I mean, we're actually in a cluster fence here, and all the people that are inside our cluster would dearly love to increase their sheep numbers and so forth, but the drought just hasn't allowed that. And I know, you know, people ask about comparisons of inside and outside the fence. Well, our fence has been there for 3 years now and there's no comparison whatsoever. So there's no, we've had the great benefit of no wild dogs, but we haven't had any benefits for extra pasture growth or anything like that.
When do people need to start looking to actually consider what they're doing with their stock? Is that going to be in the next couple of weeks, or what's the cut-off?
Yeah, I'd say by April, most people have made a decision what they're doing with their stock, whether they're going to destock completely and sell the few they've got left, or whether they hang on and continue to feed. But I dare say it'll depend on the rain. I don't think by especially the end of April anyhow, I think everyone will have made their decisions and which way they're going.
What will that mean for people staying in the region? Will we be seeing a lot of sales?
The ones that are still here are batting down the hatches and spending as little amount of money as they can and just trying to survive on the small amount of income that they've actually got at the moment, sort of thing, and hoping like hell that the drought will end.
Peter Lucas from Cliffdale Station, west of Wyandra, just giving us an overview of what the landscape looks like out in that neck of the woods. Very much thinking of all landholders struggling in the drought. It must be hard to hear of rain in the east when you're so dry. Let's hope a drop comes on you. Let's hope that cyclone just accidentally wheels down through western Queensland. He was speaking with Anita Bolle.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Now, we all know grass sales properties, as we're seeing in the northwest at the moment, but we're seeing CSG wells, coal seam gas wells, being advertised as part of a farm's assets in real estate promotions. Colliers International is currently selling two properties in the Surat Basin, both with wells on them. Agent Trent Hindman says the gas offers graziers a diversified income.
They're all pastoral assets, or the enterprise is grazing predominantly cattle in this region, so these properties not only have the cattle enterprise, they have the gas well income too, or the compensation. So you combine those two together and yes, you're right, it's a dual income asset. And the coal seam gas wells make them a little bit more robust on their cash flows. Each year you know you're going to receive that income, and that income each year, it's locked away, and you know that's going to help you through the dry times.
Trent, David Iliffe here. I'm just curious if it adds to the value, it must also add to the price that people pay for properties with CSG wells on them as well. Is that, that's definitely the case?
Well, it is, David. A lot of the value is they just value the pastoral asset. So they this is a sort of an emerging valuation method where they look at the gas well. And, yeah, I think the trend in that area is its land values have been going up. Recent sale at Wallumbilla was $1,200 an acre. So that Roma market has been, everything it sells now is nearly up to $1,000 an acre around those, it's like in the Surat, well-established areas that have got coal seam gas wells in them that have got good land too on top of the ground.
Trent, does it depend on the deal that the farmer has negotiated with the CSG company?
Well, it does, and that then it's not a stock standard CCA that applies to everyone. So each some landowners have a different negotiating style than others, and that's happened over the last 10 years. Some have done very well out of it, and others have executed a CCA that mightn't be as appealing to others that are looking at it. So it is it's a very mixed bag of CCAs out there.
The thoughts of Trent Heineman from Colliers International, speaking with the ABC's Belinda Sanders and David Iliffe.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Let's talk about the soil under our feet now. Years of intensive agriculture, spraying chemicals and monoculture of crops like sugarcane all add up to reduce microflora and bacteria in soils. That's well known. But now liquid biofertilisers have emerged as an option in recent years to reduce ongoing management expenses. North Queensland kangaroo Sergio Figuera farms south of Ingham. He says restoring soils is now a key part of his job, as he showed Tom Major.
They pretty well try and get the soil back to its natural state by putting the biology back in with your microbes and your funguses and bacteria that have been there sort of originally when you first cleared the land. And a lot of them got destroyed because the use of pesticides and chemical synthetic fertilizers and working practices, they're sort of non-existent in a lot of soils these days and cane farming areas.
What does that cause in terms of yield or production sort of deficiencies in your sugarcane?
It does create, to a degree, yield losses, but then it also creates extra expense to a degree because you've got to use all these extra chemicals and fertilisers to try and grow your crop.
So you've cooked up these sort of concoctions in these drums, and how much does each drum hold in terms of your biofertiliser?
Yeah, each pod's got 1,000 litres, and they're all within individual trace elements in there. But at the end of the day, I just filter them all and put them all into one big carrying tank and distribute it from there.
So the manufacturing process, how does it start and what does it involve and how long does it take?
Start off initially with 40 kilos or so of cow paunch. With that, you mix 200 litres of water. You put a little bit of food in there for them as well to feed off. That gets brewed for about 5 days or so. You separate it, then you fill you into another shuttle, and you fill that shuttle up to 1,000 litres or so. And in that's where you add your chelates, what you call your trace elements, your boron, magnesium, calcium, whatever you prefer. You don't have to have all of them. You can make them all calcium if you want to, but it's just individual preference pretty well.
So basically feeding and then concentrating these bacteria that are living naturally in the cow gut.
Yeah, pretty well. Yeah, you're trying to promote living bacteria in the biofert, and that takes about 40 days or so, and we just put it through a filtering system, so it makes it a little bit easier for us to apply it later on the field.
Let's check out this one over here. You were just showing me before. What's in this particular drum here?
This one's got a calcium brew in it, pretty well. They're all the shuttles are sort of sealed off, and because you've got living microbes and bacteria working in there, they release gases, I suppose. So each bottle's got a breathing system on it, and when you sort of slightly lift your breather hose out, it just lets all the air out of the shuttle, and it's a good way of checking to see that things are still happening. I'm still using synthetics, don't get me wrong, I'm just not relying on the fertiliser, so, but I'm trying to reduce them pretty well, so I'm not fully relied, hopefully not totally relied on synthetic fertilisers.
I've spoken to a lot of farmers over the past sort of couple of years who've told me they've got a real interest in developing their own biofertilisers. What are some of the setup costs and just how hard is it to do?
Setup costs aren't that great. Our biggest expense was probably our conical tank and vibrating filter, but because it was four or five of us, other growers that have been involved in Project Catalyst and were interested in making the biofert, we sort of purchased the gear and split the cost up between the four of us. So that sort of helped out a fair bit. So yeah, it's just mainly a little bit of time.
And the Bamboroo area south of Ingham, it's known as a pretty good cane growing area. It can get dry at times though, and yields, you know, can suffer at times. Have you noticed improvements over the time that you've been using these particular biofertilizers?
We do what they call chromosome tests, checks out your soil biology, I suppose, and in that trial block there has been a little bit of a difference in those couple of tests that we did. It's more of a long term, you know, we're not really applying enough of it often enough, I suppose, to make a big difference straight away.
I've got to ask, you did mention your wife. What did she think when you told her you were going to start brewing your own fertiliser 50 metres from the house?
Yeah, that wasn't the issue. It was more that you'll have to do it because I wasn't around at the time. I was working out the mines, so it sort of made it hard for me to be here, and because of the timing involved in washing out shuttles and transferring them into other ones and stuff like that. So, but created a couple of arguments every now and then. we get over it now, and it's been good. I've been home now, so yeah, we sort of do it together. So it works out all right.
Well, cane farming to bacteria farming. Thanks so much for showing us around your biofertilisers.
No problems. Thank you.
Darling, I've got a great idea, but you'll have to do it for me as well as everything else. Good one, Serge Figuera, a Herbert District cane grower who's trialling soil health options on his farm at Bamboroo. Thank you very much for letting Tom Major come onto your farm. It was just fascinating. Now, there's many towns across regional Australia, as we know, that are struggling to attract new visitors and residents. But what happens to a town when its population actually increases, often by urban sprawl? That's what some regional towns across Australia are having to deal with. I can think of maybe Toowoomba, the Sunshine Coast. As Tyne Logan reports, though, some are struggling to adapt.
In 2006, the Shire of Serpentine Jarrodale, which is about 50 kilometres south of Perth CBD, was a fairly quiet region of 13,000 people wanting to live the semi-rural lifestyle. But a decade later in 2016, those 13,000 people is closer to 30,000 people. And the long-standing Serpentine Jarrodale CRC has got growing pains.
For a start, the people who are coming to the district don't have the same outlook as what the people that were here originally. But the impact is really that we try to run things to cater for these kind of people, and we're not successful, and it's a problem.
Rodney Field is the treasurer of the CRC, and he says because of the rapidly expanding populations, they feel like they're now out of touch with their community, and that's something that's putting severe financial strain on the service provider.
I think that some of the things that we did traditionally, we would have to look at more closely. Probably more getting into the area of catering for the business world more than what we used to, and probably being more involved in the development of the region. So what we're trying to do is we're letting as many members of the community know that we'll call a public meeting and we'll discuss the whole thing, whether they now see value in the CRC in this particular region. If they do, what sort of changes do we have to make cater better for their needs?
The Serpentine Jarrodale CRC is hoping to turn things around, but regional town growing pains aren't limited to Serpentine Jarrodale. The Planning Institute of Australia says many regional centres across the country are also facing this. So how do you prepare? Lex Barnett is the president of the WA arm of the PIA, and he has some advice.
It's the social change that is one of the biggest issues. And if you don't keep pace with the population growth with your community amenities, then people are going to suffer a bit of overcrowding of facilities, and they're going to be resentful of the new residential population that's come into the town. And so it does create some social headaches for sure.
From a planning perspective, what can people do to prepare for it when they were once in a sleepy regional town and it's now booming and there's people coming in from every direction?
Yeah, I know. Look, good strategic planning is essential, and it's really important that the shire councils, the local government authorities and their communities get a very clear picture of what the future community is going to look like, and also gets a clear understanding of what it will need in terms of future community services and other infrastructure, education and employment needs, and of course transportation to manage that population, you know, and the changing urban fabric. I think the other thing is really, really effective communication with the existing community in planning for this change. You know, sometimes the change is less for the benefit of the existing community as it is for the future community, the community that doesn't exist. It is important that the existing communities do understand that, and they have, you know, an earlier and more direct involvement in helping to plan for that change, so it's done in a way that they understand and they perhaps appreciate better.
Do you think people really realise the extent of planning that needs to be put in place, you know, beyond the standard infrastructure upgrades when a town is growing like this?
Probably not. I think, as a general rule, people don't appreciate the complexity of, you know, what you need to consider.
There is a lot of towns still in regional WA that are quite the opposite. They're screaming out for people to come into their town and spend money there. Generally, is it a good or a bad thing for regional towns to be experiencing this growth?
Oh, look, I think for regional towns, it's generally mostly upside, because they're suffering economically and therefore socially. So it's important for the sustainability of small communities to be able to maintain their population and ideally grow. The important thing that regional communities have to be careful of is not to just embrace change at any price, growth at any cost. You know, they need to make sure that they do it the right way so that they get the positive benefits without the potential negatives that might come along with that.
Such a balancing act, something though that many would envy, with rural towns in Queensland mostly declining. That was Lex Barnett from the Planning Institute of Australia. Let's head to the Toowoomba cattle sale, where I'm pleased to report prices are up after some rain.
Good afternoon. Useful falls of rain across most of the usual supply area reduced numbers to 317 head in Toowoomba this morning. Prices for young cattle responded to the rain and the shorter supply and lifted by 14 to 30 cents and up to 40 cents in places. Cows also sold to a much nearer trend, with improvements of 40 to 50 cents fairly common. Lightweight yielding steers returning to paddock averaged 18 better at 244, sales to 260. Medium weight yielding steers to feed averaged 14 deer at 240, sales to 257. A handful of heavyweight yielding steers to feed made 259. Lightweight yielding heifers improved by 30 to average 173, sales to 192.2. A couple of outstanding medium weight yielding heifers to feed made 240.2, the remainder close to 189. A handful of heavyweight yielding heifers sold to the trade at 228.2. Medium weight two score cows average 174, and good heavy cows made 224.2 to average 223. This has been Trevor Hess from MLH Livestock Reporting Service.
And I'm so pleased to report that Trevor Hess even got some rain over the weekend. He tipped 69 millimetres from his gauge near the Bunya Mountains. So glad he got some rain, as did others. Tracy's reported 57 millimetres at Kilburnie near Moonee. Amanda got 40 millimetres at Bimbadeen near Monto. Margaret's tipped 66 millimetres from her gauge at Rosewood in the Lockie Valley. And Glenn, I'm so pleased for you. South of Warwick is celebrating after scoring 102 millimetres since last Friday. I hope that cyclone does something outrageous. Thanks for your company this afternoon. It's 1 o'clock.